Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We are a network of tech founders, investors, and connectors, and our aim is to support startups on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this since 2003. We're active across Australia. We've got over 5,000 members. So if you're interested in joining us, please check us out and sign up as a member at innovationbay.com. Now, if you like this podcast, and we really hope you do, please do tell the world about us on social media. And if you're feeling super generous, you could also rate us wherever you listen to your podcast. We love hearing your feedback, so please do let us know how we're doing and who else you might like to hear on the show. My guest on the show today is Tim Power. Tim is the founder and CEO at Inquisitive, which is an edtech startup that he launched in about 2017. He's probably best known from Mathletics, which if any of you out there have got children or have grown up in the last few years and just come out of school, you may have known it as a peer-to-peer mathematics sort of gamified solution. So basically educated kids in maths and they got into a few other areas too. It really was a global powerhouse, which Tim built up over, God, it must be 12 years or so. He listed the business in 2014. It was called 3P Learning. And then fairly unceremoniously, Tim left a year later. So we talk about that journey and what happened. But at the time, I think it was a over $300 million listed business. So a spectacular success in that edtech space. I've known Tim for quite a long time. I knew him back in the Mathletics days. I've always known him as an exceptional founder, but relatively unsung, especially in the startup sector now. Again, about halfway through 2017, I caught up with him. I was at AWS at the time and he called me. I thought, ooh, Tim Power's on the phone. This is cool. And I went over to see him. This is after he'd launched Inquisitive and helped him with thinking about how to scale the business and gave him some credits and, you know, a few of the other introductions to the AWS team. So I think we helped. And then reconnected in 2018 after I'd left AWS and joined Jelix. So Andrea and I both hung out with him, spent some time with him, talked through what he was trying to do. Tim decided to raise a round and Jelix was fortunate enough to get in on that. We couldn't do the whole round ourselves, so we introduced Airtree. So John Henderson, Airtree came in. So it's, yeah, there's three of us now who help Tim on the board. So there's me, John, and Kim Jackson from Skip Capital that came in as well. So look, Tim is one of the most passionate founders I know. You know, as I said before, he prefers quietly achieving than making a big noise and waving his arms about it. So really delighted to get him in the show and wave his arms for him. Some really great insights from our chat. So he's a great founder. He just exudes passion. He's resilient. He's got extreme hustle and just a ton of talent. He's one of the best founders I've ever come across. So let's go and hear from Tim Power. Okay, welcome everyone. We are here today with Tim Power. We're actually coming from the Inquisitive headquarters in deepest Mosman. What's this called? Middlehead?
It's called Middlehead, yes.
It's pretty cool. I mean, you drive through, suburbia in Mosman and then you come out in this peninsula almost and you drive down this little road and it feels like a sort of army barracks or something. I mean, what is this place?
It's, it is an old army barracks all the way back to about 1870, actually. I think the Crimean War was was around that time. And so they were building defences because Australia was worried about the French and all sorts of people.
Wow.
So amazing fortifications around here. And you know, you look out between the two heads and beyond the horizon.
That's beautiful. Good place to launch a tech business, which we'll get into. So, look, Tim, you're, I suppose, best known for Mathletics, and we'll talk about that. But you're now at the helm of Inquisitive. And I'll have said in the intro, I do have some insight, like Jelix is an investor in Inquisitive and it's been an amazing journey. So we just keep turning up and you keep delivering and surpassing expectations. So an amazing story, which I want to get into. Maybe let's start with, I'm going to quote from LinkedIn, which is a kind of lazy podcaster's way of doing it. But your strapline in LinkedIn is founder, education thought leader, entrepreneur and innovator. Now, I know you and I know that you are all four of those, but how do you think of yourself?
Someone who loves to solve big problems and really invest the time to do that. It takes a decade to solve a problem well. And sometimes you only understand it towards the end of that decade. Of course, you need to have early success. Some of your initial hunches have to hit the mark. But this, you know, for me, yeah, if I look back on the journeys I've had, they've been working really collaboratively with teams to solve big problems. And, you know, I'm not a solo entrepreneur. I'm not a solopreneur. I'm certainly not a dictator of missions and visions. I love that deep collaboration with teams, that shared co-creation of those visions and missions which solve those big problems.
But that's not really the very snappy elevator barbecue pitch. So when you're there, you know, over Christmas, because we are recording this just before Christmas, I think this will come out in January, but in the next few weeks, when people that you don't know say, what do you do? What's your answer?
EdTech, I help kids learn. I help teachers really enjoy what they do. I keep it very simple. I always try to understate what we do. I really don't like overstating. I grew up in an Australian era where you didn't trumpet your successes, and I find LinkedIn quite embarrassing, actually. So I find that very difficult. So for me, I really love to understate what you deliver a customer and what you do.
Okay. Well, I'm going to embarrass you a little more with a little bit more from the bio. So Tim has co-founded and created some of the world's largest education communities. So I really do want to dig into the community piece, but World Education Games, World Maths Days, Mathletics, and ClickView. Tim won the 2015 Piercy Foundation Entrepreneur Award, and you were the national winner of the 2015 EY Entrepreneur of the Year Award in the tech category, which is pretty amazing. You're also a lawyer, so you got a law degree from Sydney Uni. So look, you can underplay it all you like. I mean, look, I've been suggesting for a little while that you should get on the show, but I've just been watching you like performing rather than, performing quietly, I should say, rather than waving your arms and making a noise about it. So I'd like to hear you're making a noise about it. But look, we're going to rewind a bit. You grew up in Sydney's north, so you went to Knox School. It looks like you took a year out. Just again, LinkedIn, lazy podcaster, but Sydney Uni Law and Arts from 91. But first question, why did you want to study law?
I loved maths and English, and in equal proportions. So my eldest has just been doing the HSC, and I had that vivid memory of having to do 4 unit maths and 3 unit English on the same day because the Department of Education at the time decided that no one would actually be doing that. I think it's a little bit more common now. But so, yeah, it's really an odd scenario. And I thought, well, law seemed like a great thing to learn and use. And I actually really enjoyed the law. Late in my law degree, I really knew I wanted to pursue something much more open and creative.
Yeah. And what was your uni life like?
I didn't actually study maths at university, but I spent a lot of time in the actual maths library. There was a dedicated library just next to Cars Law. At the time, I was developing an algorithm for arbitraging on horse racing. and I ended up paying for a very substantial part of my university course, and I bought a car. And
wow.
In those days, the arbitrage was quite big because the market was so inefficient. I used to have quite a lot of fun with the mathletics team on Melbourne Cup Day because I could take them out and show them arbitraging, and we'd arbitrage all day. And a lot of our team would say, well, don't pay us bonuses, just give us tips. Unfortunately, I don't have time to do that anymore, but it was something of enjoyment, but it gave me a view that mathematics would give you these quite precise and quite deep insights into the world if you can marry them with a qualitative view of the world. And so it really opened my eyes to some really interesting things. So uni life was fabulous. I did lots of theatre, lots of sport. Sydney Uni is an amazing university just for all the diversity of things you can do. Yeah. You meet some amazing people. I met some incredibly bright people at university who've gone on to do incredible things. So, yeah.
Now, you were a lawyer because, again, looking at your CV, it's kind of there is a gap between about 6 years from 96 to 03. So, but you did practice law for a little while.
Yeah, right? So I did a clerkship at Phillips Fox and went into commercial litigation there for just under a year, it was, after I finished university, and loved it, absolutely loved it. It was really fast-paced. You had to move. You had to really make a lot of judgment calls very quickly. The thing that really made me decide not to continue as a lawyer was I was running a case for it was an electricity company, a very big one, and they had these, those substations, electricity substations, and they'd built them right up against people's homes at the time, and it caused real health issues because they have these terrible vibrations. And I was defending the electricity company. And because the lawyer on the other side was just so hopeless, this poor, the woman he was representing, her case fell apart. You know, the electricity company wanted to take her house as the case fell apart, and they really negotiated hard. I ended up having to negotiate for her with the electricity company to leave her a house and just to call it quits, when, of course, the electricity company was completely in the wrong.
Right.
But by sheer doggedness on my behalf, I'd completely twisted the law to their advantage. And I just thought to myself, I can't do that. I know deep inside me I've got to truly believe in what I'm doing. And as a lawyer, of course, you don't have to do things you don't want to do, but it just, there was a discord, and I wanted to seek something new, bigger, wider anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, that I guess is the start of your entrepreneurial journey. So 2003, you launched ClickView. So, you know, this time I'm guessing you're early 30s, you know, you'd have a great job as a lawyer, probably getting paid pretty well, and you decided to pack it all in to be a startup founder. What was going through your head?
Well, ClickView was a really interesting one because there wasn't iTunes or Netflix. You know, the notion of digital video was a pretty left of field thing at the time. And after I left the law, I'd been working in educational publishing with a small startup, and the person who invested in ClickView and then Mathletics, Matthew Sandblom, and certainly mentor and great thinker. And I met a young guy from the Uni of New South Wales who'd been working on a patent for how to deliver digital video. And he's explaining it to me, and I thought, wow, that sounds so cool. That's exactly what we should be doing in schools. We need something that 1,000 kids can be consuming and using video because it's such a powerful way to learn. And so we got going. Off we went. And at the time, there wasn't a VC market. You know, you didn't raise money. You just had to live off nothing.
Yeah.
So he was building, I was designing, we lodged a patent, and I remember driving out to a school with him, and I'd arranged to show a school. I think it was actually Askham. And we walked in, demonstrated the product, and the guy was incredibly nice. He knew we were absolute hacks, but he knew we'd built a really good product at that point, even though it was a little bit thin. And he went, yeah, I'll buy that.
Wow.
And he asked us how much, and I thought, oh God, I don't know what to say here. Made up some number. Gave him a business card, and we jumped in the car, and Evan said, so you did a lot of work working out that pricing model, didn't you? And I went, yeah, we had that, you know, a lot of detail went into that. And then I realized when I looked at the business card I'd handed him, we'd never bought a phone or plugged it in. We'd sort of got the phone number but never done anything about it. So we had to race back to the office, plug the phone in just in case he called the number.
Did he?
Probably, actually. I think a few people called that number eventually, but it, you know, it's
yeah, it's amazing because, you know, in some ways, I remember when I first met you, we compared entrepreneurial journeys, but, you know, I started Vicorp in 2002, which was in video as well.
Yes.
And, you know, this was 3 years before YouTube didn't launch till 2005.
Yes.
And there was no VC market. I mean, I worked with Ron, who was a sort of benefactor, you know, I guess the equivalent of Matthew. For you. So, it, you know, and the sophistication now of founders and the whole investment and startup market is way beyond what it was back then. So, yeah, I do share some of these insights from you. It was a tough time. So, I mean, let's jump a year ahead because Mathletics came along about a year after ClickView, it seems. So, and that's kind of odd for a startup founder to jump from one to the other, if that's what you did. So how did that all happen?
Yeah, so we were making great progress with ClickView, and we thought, wow, this is a really good business. And I'd really been wanting to do maths for a long time, as had Matthew Sandblom. And a friend of mine, Shane Hill, had been working on sort of, there were these workbooks for secondary schools where it was trying to divide the topic into little topics, and they weren't great, but he'd done these little sort of lesson starters on the side, which was little adaptive activities. They were clever. They were really cool. And so I think he sold $16,000 of these, and we thought, wow, well, you know, there's probably something in that. So he put some money in, I put some money in, Matthew put in probably the bulk of the money, and we started Mathletics. It was actually called Scaffold Education, purely because that was the name that Shane had started with his his workbooks at the time.
Yeah.
And look, scaffolding is an important concept in education. It was a dreadful company name and product name. And so we built a CD-ROM, and it was pretty terrible too. We sold a few of it. We scratched our way through, and it was actually Visual Basic on Excel, amazingly, on a CD-ROM.
Wow.
Used by 500 kids in a school. And it was a dreadful product, but there were seeds of something there of what we could do that was great. And it was actually my co-founder at ClickView, Evan Clark, who said, look, I've got an idea. And he went away on a weekend, came back on a Monday morning, and he built this very simple black and white game engine for kids to compete, people to compete with each other live in simple arithmetic. And so there was me, the CTO at the time, Javier Woodhouse, Shane and Evan. We played for about 90 minutes trying to beat each other up with simple maths. Four nerds going at it. And it was really fun. It was really cool. We went, wow, there's something in that. So we had the challenge at that point. Every business had these challenges. We had this CD-ROM that we were selling. We could make some money out of this, or do we chuck it in and forfeit the revenues and just go all in on using this gaming technology and then building the maths around that? Really tough call, because we were starting to look like we could make some decent money on the other side of the business. But there were so many problems, and Shane really pushed for it. And so we made the leap. And
back then, this was still all browser-based, is that right?
Yeah.
So that was really unusual back then.
Pretty unusual.
Most software was not browser-based.
It wasn't. And yeah, so we made that leap. 2005, got an engineer who is now one of our lead engineers at Inquisitive here, Kai Cheng, joined us 2005.
And he
built that initial game engine with Shane, and they did a great job. Matching kids, and it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful piece of work, and we threw it up, and suddenly, you know, kids are queuing up in the playground to do simple arithmetic.
And just to nerd out for a bit, what technology did you build it with?
It was, to be honest, to be embarrassed on the front end was Flash, actually.
Right. Well, back then that was normal. Like, there was a ton of Flash.
Yes.
And so it was almost a default.
Default, yeah. So we, there were things like we couldn't use sockets because of the way schools block things on networks and so on. So we had to do some funky things there.
Yeah.
We used .NET and some basic things. So it was.
But it has to be light because, I mean, there was probably still dial-up modems and stuff back then.
Yes. I mean, Flash actually helped with that in some ways then.
Right.
In many respects, Flash did great.
Because it preloads it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of advantages of that once the load has happened.
Yeah.
So we certainly got some advantages from that. And we built it very badly too. Just as we were coming up to public listing in the cabinet in the 3P office was the original server that the whole product ran on until 2010. And I still thank IBM that didn't go down, because we would have been absolutely dead. We didn't cover ourselves in glory in that respect.
So, look, Mathletics is a sort of fantastic journey. I mean, it's quite long, and I'm sure there's a ton to the story. So, I'm not going to ask specifically, but, you know, there's roughly 10 years. You did list it, but maybe we'll take the listing part separately. But from the start to the listing, what were the highlights and what did you learn?
I loved traveling around the world and visiting schools and meeting people. I met people from all walks of life.
Where were the main markets?
Main markets were, we were number one in Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Africa, UK, Canada. At the time that I left 3P Learning, we were about number five in the States, but certainly number one in New York and a few places.
Wow.
And it was really promising. I could see the world opening up for us. So, you know, we were in a lot of markets. We were in almost every conceivable country. It was certainly building virally very nicely. So meeting incredible people, I met the human calculator, Scott Flansburgh, his computational ability is just extraordinary. And he could wow a bunch of kids. So he became a great friend. And I met, for example, in Saudi Arabia, we literally had to go around with pen and paper and write down the names of kids and build up lists of kids to build databases to give them their maths on computers. And so, you know, we did things like that, incredible things like that. I met Norman Gillespie, who was running UNICEF in Australia at the time. Such an inspirational person who really understood how to make philanthropy and activity work. And he was the one who really connected us into the UNICEF family to do the World Education Games. And that became such a phenomenal thing. You know, 6 million kids gaming against each other, you know, a million transactions happening every second.
Wow.
Scoreboards on all their personal computers, on the country, on the world. You know, you think of the Olympics struggling to have one scoreboard of things going on. We had distributed live scoreboards on everything going on for those kids, and they loved it. And
this is still pretty early. This is what, early 2010s, 2011?
Yeah, we started World Maths Day, actually even earlier than that, but it grew into the World Education Games. And it was a really special thing in the end. We really wanted to showcase learning in the same way that we showcase sport. And we, at the end of the games, all the world champions in all the age categories, their parents, their teachers, and various, you know, political representatives would fly into Sydney, and we'd hold the medal ceremonies in the Opera House.
Wow.
And they're the most emotional events. You know, you'd see all the stuff from the events. You'd see the kids line up, these tiny little brilliant kids from all over the world, all the way to the top, and they would come from far and wide. It wasn't, you know, the world is, kids of incredible talent far and wide. That really what the mathematics journey was, meeting all those people, seeing all, you know, building out into those countries and learning the truth about what countries were about. I mean, no one would know how good the middle class kids in Pakistan are at maths. Their computational ability is astounding. For example, there are things like that that sort of get buried in the facts and figures.
So, I mean, what's interesting to me here, which I know, but I think the audience will be interested, but I mean, the way you talk about this, it's been all about impact, you know, the 6 million kids playing the emotionality of the prize ceremony. You haven't even touched on the commercial side, but I mean, this, as well as being a hugely impactful educational tool, was commercially successful too.
Yeah. I mean, look, to be honest, we only ever took on $722,222.
Right.
And we compounded that into whatever it was, about 320 million, I think it was, listing.
Yeah.
And
so it was all bootstrapped after that initial.
Yeah. So we really just generated from cash flows.
Yeah. And what was the model? Like schools paid, is that right?
Yeah. All schools, all parents.
Right.
And it was just an annual recurring subscription. So pretty simple stuff, really. Well, it seems simple now. At the time, yeah. You know,
there's a bunch of complexity. I mean, I'm thinking back then. I mean, there's no AWS. I don't know whether you're using distributed cloud computing back then, but just dealing
with AWS.
No, yeah. It wasn't. I mean,
so it was that IBM server, and then that became, you know, a server farm, which
yeah.
is pretty amazing, which we would run ourselves. And then of course eventually AWS came along. But you forget in 2000 and when we started in 2005, we had to go out to schools and say to them, look, you're not going to own this. It's not like you buy it and own it. You pay a fee every year, and you pay less than you normally would if you wanted to buy it.
Yeah.
And some schools just refused to buy it because they couldn't shift to that concept. And, you know, obviously AWS and other things came along for that, you know, that service model where you pay a lot less, but you get the full service
yeah.
of the entire product.
So we should talk about 2014. So you decided to list. I'm sure you decided earlier because a process like that would take a while. So probably sometime in 2013, you thought, look, I built a good business here. Maybe we should list. I mean, what can you talk through your thinking around that point?
So I'd love to say we planned it in 2013. We hadn't.
Right.
We decided, we met in January 2014. And it was, you know, do we want to list this and why would we list it? It gave a good exit to some of the shareholders at that point if we were successful listing. And it would allow the team to continue building. I could see this business going a very, very long way.
Yeah.
So listing seemed to be a logical thing. Actually, we listed about 5 months later. It was a huge amount of work.
Yeah.
I don't think I slept for 5 months. But we also did a book build pre-listing. So it was all done, all sold ahead of time. And I then went on holidays for 8 days before the listing, literally came back the day of,
right.
or the day before. And it just was a really great moment for EdTech in Australia because EdTech in Australia is strong. It's a really fabulous industry with some great people, the young talent out there and the things that are being built. It's just awesome. I love it. And strong industries have a habit of feeding off each other and setting a high bar and So it was a really great moment for ed tech in Australia and for schools. You know, we are a great education country. A great education country grappling with how to shift as technology shifts. And I think we will make a great fist of it.
Yeah.
So that was a really exciting moment. You know, we were the second largest tech listing on the ASX.
Yeah, I think I remember. It was Freelancer and then you.
Yeah, and yeah. We only missed them by a million. Literally. Yeah, not that we realized. Yeah, yeah. We had no idea. As you can tell, we had no idea at every step along the way. But, you know, so that was a pretty good moment. And to be honest, listing was fabulous for the business because, on the whole, I really enjoyed it because, particularly in North America, it gave us all this credibility when we were pitching for bigger contracts.
Yeah.
It answered just a lot of questions very quickly. It certainly made us grow up a lot more than we were.
So what happened?
Yeah, look, it was an unfortunate decision for me on the makeup of our board of directors, who obviously, I mean, we were very harmonious and it was quite a left of field thing 18 months after listing. When I met with the board just to have a quick catch up prior to a strategy meeting, and they said, thanks very much, Tim. It's been great. Which, of course, you can't do legally.
Yeah.
And they'd breached every ASX rule I could think of, amongst many other things. But I agreed with them at that point to leave thinking, well, I wonder what I'll do.
Yeah.
Will I take some time out? Will I come back? It's pretty hard because I'd lived around the world with this product. My whole network, my life was deeply connected to that. And I don't think they really understood how outstanding that team was.
Yeah.
They delivered probably four or five product world firsts. And that doesn't magically drop out of the air. You can build a good product and copy other people and do something slightly better. But these were absolutely brand new, original to the world. And that was the real X factor of that team. They could produce real magic and produce it with no money.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty tough one, Ian.
I remember, like, we talked about it because the same thing, happened to me. I kind of tapped in the shoulder, you know, at what wasn't a board meeting, but it was kind of a board meeting and said, you know, we're looking at a new CEO. And I'm like, is this how you deal with the founder? And it's quite it's a very sort of private equity, you know, deep finance kind of approach to life, which is just seeing people and companies all wrapped up in the same thing as this asset to be dealt with. And it just doesn't work in this startup space.
It doesn't. It's not how it works, and it's not what the drivers of success were. I mean, had they, for example, come to me and said, look, we really think for the next phase of the business, we need to change how we run this, but, you know, I would have engaged with it.
Yeah.
I probably still would have disagreed with them and told them they're a bunch of idiots. But I certainly would have thought about it very deeply and what the business needed and the changes that may need to be made. But I mean, the biggest challenge for me, Ian, was we were bounding ahead.
Yeah.
We were miles ahead of our forecasts and we were thriving.
This is a big business. I mean, you're about $350 million thereabouts listed.
Yeah, it's a serious business. And I could see us being a billion dollar business in that next 12 months because a few little steps that we were going to make that were actually quite simple.
Yeah.
And that's what I was really excited about. And I thought, well, that's a great thing. A $1 billion company, that starts to give you real leverage to do some interesting things. And it's real shame to have seen how it's been squandered since. It's certainly, yeah.
Well, look, let's not dwell on that. Let's talk about the more exciting stuff. I really want to get into Inquisitive. So, I mean, you took a little bit of time. I think you surveyed the scene, licked your wounds, decided what to do, and then Inquisitive came along. So tell us about that.
Yeah, and look, like do you want to become a director? Do you want to sit back? Do you want to work behind people? And I am a director of a few companies and I enjoy that very much because the people in those companies are exceptional.
Yeah, you're still with ClickView. It's still going.
ClickView is going great guns. I love that team. It's a fabulous product, fabulous group of people.
Yeah.
And I work with a bunch of young guns at Style Education who are really outstanding as well. So, look, I really do enjoy that very much. And you ask yourself the question, have you got the energy and the youth and is there a real purpose to what you want to do? And I just felt, Ian, I was at that cross section in my life where I had enough knowledge and I was still young enough that I could go and solve something even better than I'd ever solved before.
Yeah.
I could parlay all that. And certainly there were things bubbling around the back of my head of where we were going to take 3P learning, which I think would have gone to a fascinating space. And so there were some seeds bumping around in my head. And so what I did was I took 6 months out. Obviously spent a lot of time with the family, but in between doing that, I visited classrooms all around the world. So in Australia and then traveled overseas, and just watching what was going on in the classroom and in the schools and talking to teachers, looking at the technology they were using. And I didn't go with a preconceived purpose. And after a while, I realized that we were giving teachers an impossible job. There is no industry in the world where workers would accept what they're being asked to do. It's just the teachers are such good people
that
they accept it. They don't have the time to do their job properly. And interestingly enough, technology has been a big culprit in making their jobs more difficult, because even very good technologies don't fit together coherently. And even the leading technologies in our space, learning management systems, were fundamentally enshrining quite clunky practices that were consuming a lot of time. They digitized how people interconnected, but actually it was driving outcomes backwards. And if you look at the PISA results, those companies that have invested most in technology are those that have gone backwards.
Right.
Because of that consumption of time and money, and you still haven't got to the learning and the improvement of the learning.
Yeah.
So it, and again, some of those products are very good for what they were set out to do, but I think there's a fundamental flaw there. And so we gave teachers an impossible job, and I listed about 20 different things, barriers to teachers being able to teach, quite a depressing list. And I thought, wow, I don't want to show a teacher this because they'll never want to teach again. And I think there's a real malaise in teaching. They love teaching and they love connecting with kids, but they sort of quietly hate the job because it's impossible.
Yeah.
So I got a small group together, and one of them was Sarah Rich, who was a brilliant, brilliant educator, brilliant thinker. And she really encouraged me to do something. She'd stop licking my wounds, you know, get on with life and do something good. And
had you worked with Sarah in athletics, or was this
briefly? Yes, right. Yes. And I'd loved working with Sarah because she really conceived World Literacy Day with me.
Right.
Like and one other, Jen Gilmore at the time. The thing I loved about Sarah was she was responsible for a product called Spellodrome, which was kind of a side thing we did early on that we always kept going, well, we'll stop selling that and stop, you know, and every year it would come back and keep generating a few million in revenue, and we just couldn't shut it down. And Sarah came in as responsible for that. And we always assumed we'd put her on something else. And when it came around to budgeting time, Sarah would have 1.5 people working for her. And she'd say, can I have some more money to do stuff? And I'd look at the budget and the priorities. And I'd always say, Sarah, I'm really sorry. No, you have to subsist on what you've got. And if you can make good, you can make good. Because I'm very ruthless in strategy about putting your money and resources into the core driver.
Yeah.
I think that's a really important question for strategy and a really important thing for any founder or entrepreneur, to put their money into the core of what they're doing. Don't spread it out thinly. And every year she would innovate in these really clever ways to sustain the product with virtually no money. And we became really good friends as a result, because I was always very upfront. I always rolled up my sleeves and got involved with her to come up with some ideas to make things work and happen.
Yeah.
And so I knew that worked. And so she kicked, you know, told me to stop licking my wounds. And we really knuckled down to that list of barriers and went, well, I think we can see an idea of just simplifying for the teacher, solve for that problem fundamentally. And I worked on a patent with a couple of people, the guy who's now head of our AI and another guy, Luke Tomes, who's a good friend. We put together a pattern of how we could simply nicely, with some good algorithms, organize for the teacher. So it would just smart organize their teaching program. And I think that's a pretty cool concept to have patented that, because I think that will be something quite significant over time.
And this is when, 2017, is that right?
2017. And so we did those sort of little things, and then we built the product and threw it out there in January 2018.
Yeah.
And
because I remember, because you reached out to me when I was at AWS, and it was in 2017, and I'm like, wow, Tim Powers on the phone. That's pretty cool. And so I came out here.
I think I was thinking, wow, Ian Gardner's
up. Oh, no, I was pretty pumped to come out here. And then, you know, you were in the same office. And there was no one here. It was kind of you and I think Sarah was around, maybe one other. And you're like, you know, I was just deeply impressed because, having been through what you'd been through and been, you know, blooded, I suppose, by it, and knowing how hard it is to launch another startup from scratch, you were back in the trenches with your shirt off wrestling the crocodiles. And it was like, wow, this shows conviction, which was deeply impressive. You know, I think we helped you a little bit with, you know, usually the main weapon in the armory was credits. So we helped with some credits, but some engineering. And, you know, I just remember watching that progress. And then, yeah, you did launch in 2018, and it's been, you know, maybe I should turn this into a question rather than just this monologue, but, the progress since, I mean, it's been remarkable. So, I mean, do you want to touch on what Inquisitive has done, and what you're most proud of?
Yeah, I mean, I love that we, for example, in 2020, I think we'll get to about 1.5 million lessons and assessments have been used by teachers in classrooms. That's pretty amazing.
Yep.
I think it's around about getting close to 70% of Australian primary schools use it now, have adopted it.
I mean, that's huge, 70%. I mean, in a school market, and you don't even have a sales team.
No sales team. They just word of mouth. You know, it's got to be a good product to do that.
It sure does.
It's got to be a very simple one.
Yeah.
That's been amazing.
And I mean, for the uninitiated, what is it? I mean, how do you describe the product now?
It's just a simple, we describe it as it's history, geography, science and technology and English and integrated units for teachers. So we keep it at a very simple level. It's a curriculum organizer at its heart. That's what it does, and that's what it does very well. I'm really excited where it's going to go to in the next little steps.
But there's lots of benefits. I mean, one of the things that you talk about is the amount of time that it saves teachers every year. So, I mean, do you want to touch on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting one because you know, everyone says their product saves teachers time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be a bit of a mantra. But we really genuinely made a mission. We listed all the things that what took up a teacher's time, and we've been picking them off one by one and just literally eliminating that time. And so we survey teachers every year and we track that very closely. And I think we're getting close to 100 hours a year for each of those primary school teachers, which is huge.
Because teachers only work 6 months a year, is that right? I shouldn't say that too late.
So it's pretty significant time factor. And at that point, if you look at the studies on impact on student learning outcomes, that puts us about fourth on the list of things that change student learning outcomes in terms of the effect size. And our goal is to get to 300. If we get to 300, we'll have the most significant impact on student learning outcomes by effect size.
Yeah, wow.
So that's exciting. And it's a really interesting frame of reference, Ian, because if you think back to your days when you were founding Video in 2002, digital video, we had this mantra, which might have been an accident, but it's in an old PowerPoint. Remember the old Microsoft PowerPoints with the guys running around the racetrack, all those preset ones?
Yeah.
It's on one of those old slides. But we said that we didn't just want to digitize the function. It wasn't enough. It had to make it faster, lighter, or better, and or better. And I think the mistake of products in this first 10, 20 years in that period since that time is they've just essentially been digitizing it quite well, but not making it faster, lighter, better than the analog real world experience.
Yeah. Cause I mean, we're a long way from when I was at school anyway in Scotland, like we had blackboards with chalk and, you know, I remember one of the innovations was a whiteboard with these fancy markers and they still use the overhead slide projectors with their little pens. I mean, now it's all, you know, smart projectors and tablets for the kids. And you're playing right into that. So it's not just that it's saving them time, but it's improving the experience for the teachers and the pupils, yeah?
Absolutely. It's improving the fundamental base of the learning design. Time is one of the things we focus on. The other one is I do think there's two other things that we really try to focus on. One is I do think we can get Australian kids into the top five in PISA by 2032. And I think there's some fundamental things that we can do in this next 12 years that will deliver that.
And where are we sitting right now?
It's in the teens.
Okay.
you know, I think we should be about five. I don't think we need to be number one, but I think we certainly need to improve our relative performance. But yeah. I think where we want Australian kids to be number one is on critical and creative thinking.
Yeah.
And it needs to be built into the curriculum and learning design for that to happen quite explicitly. And so we've done a huge amount of research into that area and got that nicely down and embedded into the curricula.
Yeah.
And it will have a big impact on the results.
So I want to dig into that number. I mean, 70%, I think when we first met you, it was, I don't know, you're maybe at 20% of Australian elementary schools that were using it. So to get to 70% in a market like this with no sales team in a short period of time, I mean, basically 2.5 years, is pretty remarkable. And one of the things I wrote down in my notes is the, you know, your ability to harness a community. So, I mean, how do you think about communities and where does teaching play into that thinking?
Your communities are fascinating things. They're communities. I mean, firstly, what are they? They are groups of people that coalesce around something they like to do and have strongly shared beliefs, not universally shared beliefs, but some core drivers. And so, I mean, that's really what communities are. And you know, teachers really want to, you know, you have to ask the question, well, what do teachers want to do? They want their kids to learn with purpose and depth, and they want to enjoy their jobs. It's quite two simple propositions. So we, you know, when we talk to teachers, we say, look, we just want you to enjoy teaching. We want to take away the hassle, and because we know that you're fabulous with the kids, we know you are just learning beautifully for kids of different abilities and temperaments. So they're two very simple propositions. And if I think they're the ideas that the communities that we're working with work around, learning with purpose and depth. You know, when I went at Mathletics at 3P Learning, I really brought to bear my personal philosophy around love learning. Thought that that's fundamental because that's your shield for life. If you can love learning, you'll jump some big barriers. And when I had some time out and I started to think about that a little bit more, I realized there was a little bit of a flaw in that because sometimes learning isn't fun. Sometimes you just can't. Sometimes it's quite painful. It's a bit like creativity. You know, if you're really stretching your brain on, it's deeply satisfying when you get to the end point. So I'd realized that love learning had an implicit flaw in the way I was presenting it and thinking about it. And that's where Inquisitive came from, because it is purpose that makes you jump hurdles. If you believe in something, you'll learn it.
Yeah.
I was just watching my son recently who is fairly academic, doesn't study extensively, but he recently had a school camp and he had to develop all these things for it. Because he so wanted to deliver on that, he worked so hard on it and produced the most magnificent materials, better than anything I'd ever seen him produce before, because of the purpose.
Yeah.
So purpose and depth is really important. So you give that very clear purpose for the students and the teachers, and you scaffold, so going back to Shane's words and those important foundations of building great resources, you scaffold it so that every kid can go as deeply into that as they possibly can in the time available.
Yeah. No, look, it's an amazing story. You know, I'm always struck with the way that teachers, I mean, it's almost like a self-selling. I mean, it's kind of like Hotmail, you know, do you want free Hotmail? And people just forwarded it on and other people saw it. I mean, what are the key areas of community? I mean, I know there's a Facebook group that's pretty popular with teachers. Is that one of the main ones?
Lots of Facebook groups. I guess that's one of the things that we need to work on over the next year or two, are those community tools within the resource so they can do all that sharing and community. But yeah, Facebook is a big part of it.
Yeah.
I
just want to touch on the funding. And there's a lot of founders that listen to this show, so they're always interested in how you raise money. So, I mean, it's back 2018. I think we reconnected. You know, I'd left AWS at that point. And you were like, hey, we're out thinking about raising some money. You'd already shoveled a few million bucks into it by that point. I mean, do you want to touch on what was going through your head? Why didn't you do it yourself and what you're hoping to achieve with a round of funding?
I like the collaboration. And to be honest, Dan, at that point in time, I didn't think we'd need funding.
Right.
And we certainly didn't necessarily need to take it. I actually literally met with you and Andrea and thought, wow, really good people. I could, you know, I could work with you, and that would be really good for me, because then it wouldn't just be me in a bubble. And so I really undernarred whether I was going to do it. I wasn't meeting you to actually seek funding at the time.
Yeah, and I remember that.
You then connected me to John Henderson at Airtree, who is super smart, super sharp, and, you know, I couldn't help but be incredibly impressed.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of John's.
And then I spoke to a couple of other people and went, well, do I do this or not? And it all happened in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So yeah, to be honest,
I mean, you were a whole property at that point. I mean, everyone you're talking to was like, fuck, Tim Power, we'll give you money.
Yes. Well, you might regret that. I'm sure you won't. It's a dilemma. And to be honest, if I didn't think that the people I'd be working with, were going to back us and really help us think about it and challenge us in the right ways, then I wouldn't have taken on that funding at that point in time. I just wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
I really like the counsel of leadership that I get from you and John and Kim Jackson and Jason Lenger and others.
Yeah.
Such, because you constantly challenging, but not to be the smartest person in the room and catch us out for some indelible flaw. Like you accept that we're going to have weaknesses. You know, you're going to accept that there are some things we're not going to do well. As long as we're working hard and solving for the big things. And that's what I really like about it. So for any founder looking for money, find people who you genuinely think you can work with first and foremost, I would have thought.
Yeah. Look, it's a long-term relationship, and it's easier to get out of a marriage than it is an investor. Although in my case, it's both, so I don't want to get out of either. So just quickly add. One of the other things that I've observed in the last 2 years is just, I mean, you touched on it earlier, just with that relentless focus on strategy and goals and a few other things. And you talked about it. I mean, I think I read in one of the articles when I was doing my research here that, you know, some advice for teams who need to be agile and make fast progress. And there were three things you said. So set strategy every 2 months, include personal and development goals, and run your weekly meetings on a Friday. And I'm sure there's a bunch more, but do you want to touch on how you think about goal setting and managing your team with the cadence that you bring to this?
Yeah, I've always loved Rockefeller, which is essentially distilling down what your company's doing to a couple of important things and getting rid of everything else. And that's hard to do. The bigger you get, obviously, it gets harder.
It was Vern Harnish that kind of brought that to life, didn't he?
I mean, he's really popularized it.
Right. It was because it existed before that, but he's put it in book form and done a bunch of podcasts.
He has, and his latest book is, you know, or IP and thinking is scaling up, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. He started with the Rockefeller Habits, I think. So I love that as a concept. And in mathematics, we did it quite well in some respects and not so well in others. And I guess, for our team, we've narrowed it down now to three top priorities. And then a fourth one is a learning one, and a fifth one is a personal one. And that's very powerful, because you're narrowing your focus into absolutely things that are going to move the needle for the business. You're not spreading yourself thin.
So that's the sort of top layer, but it cascades down to every individual team layer. So how does that work?
And then every individual has to work out what they're going to do to contribute to and meet those goals. We do that, as I say, we do it every 2 months. We do it every 10 weeks. We do it in a 10-week cycle. We pair up and really develop those things. And then everyone self-tracks it every week. So you're just dropping your numbers against how you're tracking each week. And we meet on a Friday to review that, 1 hour on a Friday. And the reason for that is because I always hated that principle of having a big, heavy meeting first thing on a Monday morning. I'd spend the whole weekend knowing that meeting was coming.
Yeah.
I love reviewing the week on a Friday, knowing where you're headed the next week before you head out to the weekend, because you just feel free. And then your mind's, you know, focused on bigger, more creative things at that point in time.
Yeah, we found that too. I mean, like Friday can often feel like it's a bit of a celebration. So you tend to celebrate the wins a bit. And I think that's sometimes underappreciated in business. You've got to celebrate the wins.
Yeah, we really got to celebrate the wins. And so, yeah, we showcase stuff on that Friday. And, you know, and the other thing is, Ian, most people hate most meetings.
Yeah. True.
If you truly ask them, did you enjoy them? No, don't like meetings. And when I had that realization, I went, well, let's just get rid of meetings and have one that is light, that we enjoy as a connect. And that solved for that problem. So the, you know, so I love that rhythm of the business. The other thing was, Ian, in those early years, you know, up until now, you know, I've been juggling dropping kids at school and doing various bits and pieces and being a much more of a house dad. And by having this mechanism, we trusted each other and knew exactly what was going on. Yeah. So it actually binds a team to allow you to be flexible to all the realities of all the things you're doing. So it's and with COVID, as soon as COVID struck for us, we already had all those beautiful rhythms and mechanisms. So as we disbanded out of the office, we'd already were working 2 days a week from home anyway. We just extended that to 5. And we've come back to 3 or 4 at home now.
Yeah.
So most teams come in 1 day a week.
Yeah, we managed to go the entire podcast. I mean, we're getting to, towards the end here, but we've gone the whole podcast without mentioning COVID. So,
Sorry about that. If we could just bypass it.
Yeah, you know, it feels almost back to normal. There's definitely signs of green shoots. It's like this horrific bushfire ripped through us, and now it's feeling, you know, the wildlife and bushes are coming back. I mean, what's any observations from Inquisitive's perspective on COVID and what the impact will be?
It will certainly, I think governments are going to be much more interventionist in how things operate in ed tech and I think in all facets of life. So I think that is quite a big change. And so companies' ability to engage with those government bodies, I think, will be really important to their success.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, last question and then we'll do the quick fire. So, I mean, what's next? You've had this remarkable progress. I mean, 70% of Australian schools, you can almost see a path to get into 100. I mean, I'm sure there'll be a fairly sticky few that'll be hard to dislodge, but what's next for Inquisitive?
I guess we're thinking about overseas, starting to get serious about that. And so that's high on the agenda, and we've got some really nice.
Is that going to be tough without travel, or are you expecting that to open up?
I was planning not to travel anyway. We don't travel now,
yeah.
So why change it?
Here's the question then around that. So, I mean, I think that is possible for you because you know you've had this 20-year track record of success as an entrepreneur and doing the international. You've got an amazing network overseas. I know that, but for a founder coming in who is in Australia and is faced with the same thing. It's like, you know, the market here is getting maybe saturated or hard and we could go overseas, but they can't travel. Is that going to be as easy for them as it is for you?
It might be easier in some ways in this next wave if customers are willing to engage online, for example.
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, the biggest rule of a business is, you know, understand your customers and get close to them. You know, really know and work in partnership with them. So if you can do that remotely or you can find people who can do that for you and you trust the way they're doing it, I think that can jump those barriers.
Yeah. Well, look, Tim, you are certainly one of the best founders I've ever come across. So just to give you the love in. So thank you. And thanks for taking the time to talk through the business and
thanks, Ian. It feels like a therapy session.
No, that's fine. Well, we haven't finished yet. We're still going to do the quick fire question. So we always try and get our guests to give some recommendations to the audience. I suspect this will be going out in early January, so people might be on holiday listening to this and desperate to pick up some tips. So book recommendation.
This is a classic that most people won't have heard of, but it's A Fortunate Life, A.B. Facey, which was a classic prescribed text when I was growing up. The reason I loved it at the time was because it's a classic Australian tale of someone who had nothing and really made a great life for themselves.
With fiction?
Yeah, more almost autobiographical.
Okay,
really.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's a brilliant tale. It's fascinating. And if, you know, one of the biggest challenges as a parent is you really want to inspire your kids to want to make a great life. And you don't care where they go with it. You want them to pursue their own dreams and go for it and to have the courage to do that. And I think that book really springs to mind for something that I went, wow, yeah, make a great life. Make whatever you can out of what you've got.
Yeah. Fortunate Life. I will have a look at that one. Podcast? Do you listen to podcasts?
I do listen to podcasts. I do love conversations with Richard Feidler. I think he's the master questioner. I just admire his ability so much.
And who does he interview?
All manner of people, actually. You know, he did the most... most brilliant interview with Geordie Williamson, the brilliant mathematician, Australian mathematician, and I think runs the maths department, I think it's Sydney University, but he was one of the youngest people admitted into the Royal Society in England. He solved this incredibly difficult maths conjecture. It is a brilliant interview. Like, it's fascinating.
That's awesome.
But he's brilliant. I love, obviously, of course, Ian Gardner, goes without saying, and Gary Birtwistle. Do you know Mojo Sessions?
I haven't heard that one, no.
Gary Birtwistle, one of Australia's great thinkers and truly inspirational person.
And when do you tend to do it? I mean, have you got a dog that you walk, or because you're not really commuting much?
No, I don't have a. I do tend to. I'm pretty close to home here. I do it every day,
right,
between points. Yeah,
yeah. News source. What do you do to keep up with the news?
Yeah, I mean, I read voraciously all manner of things. I do. One of the things I do think is important is I actually tried to read The Guardian and The Australian, which are completely juxtaposed worldviews.
Yeah.
I don't agree. I usually don't agree with either of them. And I think the truth is somewhere in between or somewhere within all of that. And I think it's very important to understand different perspectives.
But when you're reporting on the news, I mean, there's something I sometimes wonder. It's like, how much bias is there in the just pure reporting, do you think?
I think people have been given a license to bias by virtue of their communities,
right,
and that reinforcement of their worldview. And which is why I think you have to read all manner of sources. I think if you constrain your sources, you only get one worldview. And I think that will leave gaps in what's going on in the world.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite tech CEO?
Favorite tech CEO? Look, the master is Steve Jobs, really. Yeah. I mean, you go and listen to any, you go and watch any of his YouTube clips. I think there's a brilliant one called Insult Response. So if you want to build a product, type Steve Jobs insult response and just listen to it, because it tells you everything you need to know. I did love, and this was something that Evan Clark, the person I co-founded ClickView with, he loved Joel Spolsky. Remember Joel on software?
Yeah,
he had,
so.
Had some brilliant blogs for quite a long time. He stopped doing it, but he did Fog Creek and things like that, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Now, this one's designed to be the fun app. So when you pull out your phone and you want to do, I mean, what are the apps on your home screen and which one do you click on the most?
No question, Spotify.
Right.
Obsessed by Spotify and endlessly searching the world for new music and interesting music. I do think.
And what's been on the playlist this year?
My favorite band of all time is a band called The Lumineers.
Okay.
Absolutely. It's incredible music.
The Aussies?
No, they're American.
Okay.
They do, pre-COVID, they used to come out here quite a bit, I think.
Right. So you could be found in the mosh pit at the Enmore or something?
Absolutely, 100%.
Productivity tool?
Slack.
Oh, yeah?
Incredible.
And what did you think of the Salesforce acquisition?
Devastated.
Really? You think it's going to wreck it?
It won't. I don't think you can wreck it, or not for a long time, but it's such a great tool.
Right.
You know. It doesn't surprise me that Salesforce bought them.
Yeah, no, we talked about it in the news podcast this week, and it seems, by all accounts, a very shrewd acquisition.
Very clever. Very clever.
And, you know, Salesforce is awash with cash, so it wasn't even that expensive.
No.
A TV show. Like, do you have time? And if so, what do you watch?
My wife runs a TV production company.
Oh, there you go. Right?
So I tend to.
So anything
she makes is incredible, of course. She does make some amazing stuff. But and I do love the way, you know, she perceives the world. But I think our family favorite is Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible.
But it's all over.
I know.
Were you happy with the ending?
I know a lot of people weren't. I still quite. Yeah, of course, it was very depressing once you've used a dragon to obliterate an entire city. And you're thinking, did we really need to end in that way?
It was pretty hard to bring, like, I don't know, like what was probably 20 separate plot lines together into one final scene.
I loved it so much. It would have had to be so terrible not to enjoy the last.
And did you have a character that you most resonated with?
Oh, I'd probably give away too much if I do.
Yeah, I was at school with a hound. That's about
really?
Yeah, he was, you know, Rory McCann. I didn't know him that well. He was a year above me.
Yeah.
He wasn't much of an actor at school. But, yeah, I remember when I was first watching it, it's like, I know that guy. Anyway, small world. And then final question, I actually should have checked this before I asked it, but have you done a TED Talk?
I haven't done a TED Talk.
Right. Well, if you were asked to do one, what would you do it on?
Solving big problems in education and schools, yeah. Something like that.
That was the expected answer, I think the correct answer. Tim, thank you. I appreciate you giving up your time this busy time of year. I mean, we're just pre-Christmas here and everyone's trying to get deals done and just finish off the year. So I know you're very busy, but I appreciate you sharing the journey and hope everyone else enjoyed it because I certainly did.
Thanks, Ian. Really fun chat.